This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I think a few different things have transpired.
Enough of the small talk.
Yeah.
All right, that was
enough. Jeez, brutal. Patriarchy is asserting itself today.
Just today, huh?
Just, well, it's getting personal.
Yeah. No, Nathan, you were saying something.
A few things that have transpired in the last week in our country. I was actually anxiously awaiting to hear both your takes on it. And perhaps this is the venue, perhaps Hawk Blocked is the venue, but what do you guys think?
We did have a fairly in-depth conversation after the leak on Hawk Blocked, so we have talked about this. But yeah, do you have new thoughts, Doug, or you want to talk about anything?
I have a few thoughts about it. My first surprise about this, I grew up, you know, by 19, I think Roe v. Wade was, 73, Jen?
I think so.
So I was, you know, just a teenager. And so my entire consciousness of that controversy was that it was basically, by the time I was a conscious, functioning civic human, Roe v. Wade was the de facto law of the land. In other words, it was just the way, you know, and anything in opposition to that was seen as futile, backwards, religious, and done. And so I didn't grow up in the 1960s. I mean, I was alive then, but I wasn't aware of anything then, except Walter Cronkite in the Vietnam War, maybe for a little bit. But point is, I didn't know anything then. So I grew up shrugging my shoulders, and I remember reading at some point, probably in my 20s, I read a little bit of detailed analysis of the Supreme Court's thinking about when is the origin of life or not there. You know, in other words, when do we start drawing the line here and et cetera. And I remember, I think it was about 6 months, wasn't that? The original Roe v. Wade, wasn't that more or less the thinking, Jen? Something in that range?
That was the viability.
End of the second trimester or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, I shrugged my shoulders and didn't care anything about it. And I've always, I've been very unconscious of this entire controversy, like literally for my whole life. Then I had an interesting thing that transpired about 6 months ago. And that is, I was having a conversation with my sister, who is now retired, but a very distinguished attorney. And my sister said to me, I have no idea what the conversation was about. We don't talk that often. It was probably a nice, friendly Christmas time conversation when she came up here to visit myself and my mother. And she said, you know, they're probably going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I just rolled my eyes, like, you got to be kidding. There's no way that is true. No, the controversy and why and all this. And she said, Doug, Roe v. Wade's a terrible decision. It can't stand. And I said, you got to be kidding. And she said, no. She says, everybody knows it. I said, she goes, all the Supreme Court justices know it. They all know it's a terribly flawed
including
decision.
Including Ruth Bader Ginsburg yeah. on record many times.
Yes, right.
Of all the champions, you know. So you can, which points to the fact that you can coexist with an opinion, a pro-choice opinion, yeah. and simultaneously with an opinion about the decision, that the decision legally was not not the best precedent and not the most legally sound.
Yeah, and this was news to me. I mean, all the controversy had basically, I had wax in my ears and didn't care. And so for the first time in my life, well, first of all, I instantly believe my sister because my sister has basically 100% credibility on just about everything. And she's not somebody that shoots first and asks questions later. She's extremely fastidious. And so I'm like, God, that's amazing. Why? And she said, it has nothing to do with abortion. It's a states' rights issue. It's very simple. It's exceedingly clear. This is constitutional law 101. And I was like, huh. I still didn't think anybody would do anything about it. But she says, oh no, they're going to have to do something about it. I'm like, why? They haven't done anything about it since I was a kid. Like, why now? And so I then went about my business and didn't think anything of it again. Kind of just passed through my consciousness. Then when we got this leaking memo, I talked to her again. She goes, oh, yeah, I told you. You know, this is it's a done deal. There's no way in hell that decision could stand. She said there could be a national law. You could have a federal law, and that's not a problem, but you got to pass that through Congress, and maybe they will, maybe they won't. But Roe v. Wade is dead. It cannot possibly survive. Wow. That was like suddenly, you know, again, my sister, who has basically 100% track record of being accurate whenever she goes on record, is right again. And so now that I understand it, then I looked at this and I had quite a few thoughts about this over the last, you know, week or so. And it's like, huh, as I was thinking about from the pro-choice side of it, the tragedies that we know that this will create, that we always knew that they would create, and always did, which is that somewhere, you know, in the middle of Texas or Arkansas or Mississippi, there is some girl with an 82 IQ with no resources and a pissed off boyfriend or father or whoever that would not, you know, even flicker a whisker of assent to her getting an abortion, but desperately wants one. And now she won't be able to manage that. She'll get caught in this net. And the difference is that, quite frankly, in 2022 versus 1973, these are vastly different landscapes. So in 1973, that meant you were pretty smart, sweet, didn't have a lot of resources, and you're embarrassed as hell, and you're in trouble. You know what I mean? And if in all over the United States, whereas today, that the statistical likelihood of you being trapped and in trouble without resources are going to be very, very small. I mean, they're still going to be there. There are going to be people in circumstances that less so financially, but more in terms of the bullying and the males around snarling and whatever the religious enshroudment or ethical issues that are around them socially. There's going to be people that are not going to be able to get on a plane or a train or an automobile and cross a state or two and get themselves to a free abortion clinic. So the tragedy will happen. Other people can legitimately say, well, there's tragedies on the other side of the ledger. True. True. And these are all reasonable arguments and concerns, etc. However, now I don't, you know, as much hand-wringing as there is and catastrophizing on the pro-choice side of this, the truth of the matter is that now that I look at the situation in 2022 and I do not see a catastrophe. The numbers look like this, that there's about 900,000 abortions performed in the United States every year. Of those, a good solid half of them are taking place in states that are, where it's totally legal, and a whole bunch more in states where there's going to be limitations at 15 or 16 weeks, whatever that the current vogue thing is. And then there's going to be maybe a third of these abortions would have taken place in states that are now going to declare them illegal. And so maybe you have 300,000 little frogs caught in the net. Okay, so where do we go from there? Well, where we go from there is that let's talk about the expenses associated with actually completely taking care of this problem. A couple weeks off work, a plane ticket, you know, a procedure, etc. At most, this is a $5,000 problem per capita. And so $5,000 times 300,000 is, I believe, $1.5 billion. And this is chump change. This is literally nothing. So this wouldn't have been the case sociologically, financially, etc., clear back in 1973. But today, it is an entirely different issue. I think all of us will recognize that, I mean, Elon Musk by himself can easily afford to finance all of the abortions that people that are in states that don't make them legal, to transport, put people up in a three-star, you know, place and have a completely relaxed time and have it done, and then go back to work and have had your work time paid for. That is one guy, okay? And he's actually said he's going to do it for all his Tesla employees or whatever. Point is that we've already seen a huge amount of corporate America line up behind this and say, yeah, they're going to do the same thing. So a big part of the problem would be, gee, I'm in some state that makes this illegal. I'm a poor little thing. What am I going to do? You know what I mean? And the answer, if I don't have enough residual income, I don't have money saved, how am I going to get on a plane? How am I going to get myself a hotel room? How am I going to pay for a procedure? All of those channel factors or obstacles are completely not in this game. And so now it's like, well, what is in the game? Well, you actually, instead of driving down to a center, you have to get yourself to an airport or a train station and take a couple days off, and that's how you're going to have to do it. It's like, okay, well, there's nobody's going to stop you. Nobody's going to be at a border with a shotgun, nothing. And so we look at this, and logistically, this is not the same sociological pressure and crisis-breeding mess that it was 50 years ago. It's not even close. It's financially nothing. It's logistically relatively trivial. It is psychologically and emotionally still stressful. But it's a pretty big difference between saying, hey, I'm in a state that it isn't illegal, and I feel oppressed, and I'm pissed off, et cetera. It's like, okay, no problem. Two things. Number one, for the once or twice in your life when you might choose to do this procedure, it's a free paid vacation to Southern California to hang out for a week, because somebody's going to foot that bill. That's one thing. The second thing is, you also, if you're upset enough about it, leave that state. Go to another state that its values are more, you know, are consistent with your vision and your choices on this dimension. Now, you might say, well, gee, that's a tall order. Yeah, it is a tall order. But
particularly for the type of person we're describing, who's cornered by family dynamics and religious edicts and everything else that's preventing their freedom of movement and choice as is, you know, very hard to pick up and get out of that situation.
Of course, no question. Yeah. So, but the point is that for those that are just offended by this and incensed, which I understand why they might be, here's the law of the land is, when you have basically a tremendous dispute between huge numbers in the country, and it's not easily resolvable, it has to be resolved at the ballot box. I mean, that's where it's resolved. And so It could easily be resolved at the ballot box pro-choice with a federal law. No problem. One was introduced. It went down to defeat in the Senate. Okay, well, it went down to defeat in the Senate. So that means that what is left? What's left is the states' rights. And so there's states all over the United States that are going to be completely supportive of a pro-choice position. And it's going to be, like I said, financially trivial. I just don't. You know, is this a shock to the system? Is it upsetting that we have this dispute for people on both sides of this? Yeah, I understand all of that. Is this a catastrophe? It's not even remotely a catastrophe. So that's why I want people to look at this with a more tempered view. We begin with the issue that Roe v. Wade itself was an anti-states' rights adjudication that made no sense in terms of the Constitution. Okay, so that turns out to be apparently me and RBG don't disagree, for God's sakes. Okay, so so as Jen says, that's point one. Now, after that point, I think Jen, who was it that said this? You're our political scientist. The notion is that the states were kind of like a laboratory of how to go about the process of governing.
That was the whole idea. You're asking me Federalist Papers trivia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Probably Madison, but I wouldn't, make a heavy bet on it.
Right. And so, this idea of, hey, this is how we're, instead of having, there may be a time and place for federal law, and maybe there is a time and place for this, but if you can't get a federal law, then you can run the experiments at the level of the states. And people can learn from their neighbors and see how things go and see what they think, see what they like, support their positions that they want at the ballot box, and life goes on. So, but I think in terms of the quiet, horrendous tragedies that took place in this country prior to Roe v. Wade, et cetera, I think we are not going back to 1962. That is not what we're doing. This is a completely different set of circumstances. And I'm not saying it's without some quiet tragedies that will happen, but it is not, it's two orders of magnitude different problem. I mean, that's how I see it. Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, I think for all of the reasons that you're describing, it's a completely different landscape. It's also a completely different landscape in terms of information that's available to young women in this position. And, mm-hmm. There's no internet at the dawn of Roe v. Wade. There's no ability to immediately go online and connect with one of many now very well-established advocacy groups. I mean, I've lost track of the number that I have personally worked for throughout the years who... Mm-hmm. Our pro-choice groups or champion pro-choice issues between, I worked for the National Abortion Rights Action League, making phone calls to canvass people because we were concerned about legislation that was coming down the pike in Washington State years ago, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood. I mean, there are plenty of top line organizations that anyone who is in this situation doesn't have to talk to too many people or Google too many things to discover. And so you're talking about kind of the corporate solution stepping in and mm-hmm. financing this process. But there's also the nonprofit side of things, where if there's somebody mm-hmm. who's truly trapped in the middle of Louisiana somewhere and in this situation, she just needs to know to send that email to Planned Parenthood, and they're going to connect her with a network of people who are going to facilitate this and make this happen for her. We also have, medical abortions in the sense that there's a pill that you can take that you couldn't take in 1973. Yeah. So it's not necessarily that you have to go be in a hospital and, physically get yourself in front of a medical team and go through this really invasive procedure. I mean, it's going to depend on every individual, but there's also, a pharmaceutical solution here that can travel across state lines. And I know there's a lot of concern that that's, that these retrograde states are going to try to legislate that and to criminalize state line travel by citizens. And you've got to remember that even if you're living in one of these states, they are still being checked by their own courts. They're being checked by their courts, their circuit courts, and eventually, if necessary, the Supreme Court as well. So you're not going to have, I mean, I worked in the Alaska State Legislature for years when these troglodytes who were, you know, representatives in the Alaska State Legislature, just, it was just a complete signaling device year in, year out to their constituency that they would try to pass these absolutely restrictive, draconian abortion laws. And they would just get shot down by the courts over and over and over again, in part because of the Roe v. Wade precedent, but also in part because they were just blatantly unconstitutional and just are not even going to pass muster in an Alaskan court, let alone the Ninth Circuit. So there has to be some kind of faith in that process, even if it has to wind its way all the way back to the Supreme Court again, which is what Roe v. Wade was initially about. It was this unnecessarily restrictive Texas law. And it was just the court sort of stepping in and making this very broad precedent and this in over-interpreting the situation in a way that made it very legally vulnerable. And its legal vulnerability has been the bread and butter of these advocacy organizations. I mean, when I was canvassing for NARAL in the 90s, it was the specter of Roe v. Wade being overturned that was financing the coffers of that organization when we were making calls to donors. It was like, we have to get so-and-so elected because we can't let this happen. And that has been, you know, that has allowed the sort of institutionalization of this pro-choice advocacy infrastructure that is now able to support these young women in this situation. So it's sort of an ironic result, but it is there for them. I think of all of this and all of the ways that this, you know, someone who is in a really tough situation just has such a different opportunity structure available to them than a woman in the early 70s had. And I think a lot of women are sort of, you know, either they were there and they remember, or they've heard from their mothers, mm-hmm. or they have just been sort of receiving this rhetoric year in, year out from the advocates and, you know, really living mm-hmm. in a lot of fear. And they're letting that transform into an erosion of the legitimacy of the Supreme Court itself, and an erosion of the legitimacy of the judicial process. I mean, we could talk about all the craziness that's going on there. You know, a lot of prominent people making critiques of the court this week, including really racist attacks on Clarence Thomas. Yeah, I mean, yeah, some of this has been around for a while, but very prominent celebrities calling him a clown in blackface, for example, like, mm-hmm. you know, an Uncle Tom, et cetera. I mean, this is just, it's amazing to me to see the sort of the effect that something like this is having on the willingness to say, okay, well, this is a decision that I don't agree with, and so I'm going to go ahead and turn my back on the legitimacy of the institution completely, when the court is really the only institution that has any legitimacy anymore in this country. And we need to rally around institutional legitimacy as much as we can. So, and I think they are. I mean, I'm not a legal scholar. I did not go to law school, but I was very interested in constitutional law for a very long time, and I thought about going to law school. And even the most crazy progressive, you know, bleeding heart, crazy people that were teaching me law classes in the 90s, they would hedge it very carefully and say, listen, I'm as pro-choice as can possibly be. And if you're ever in trouble, you come to my house and we're going to take care of you. You know, well, I'll drive you to the doctor myself. But this was a flawed decision. And so let's have a conversation about that. And let's just start our whole semester on constitutional law talking about why this was judicial overreach and why it set up a vulnerability in this decision and why it will eventually be overturned. This is what they were leading with at my little hippie college that I went to in the mid-90s. One of the very first classes I took was with a former editor of the original edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Like, you do not get more legitimate, you know, I mean, she was absolutely on the front lines. The class was called The Politics of the Abortion Rights Movement. I was really interested in the topic, and she was an expert, and she grudgingly agreed. And it mm-hmm. was all part of, and so that's why we must fight. That's why we have to be prepared. That's why we have to, you know, never let down our guard, because they're going to be coming for this. And they're coming for it because there's an awareness from the very beginning that it's vulnerable. And mm-hmm. so the whole dynamic of the whole fight over the last half century has really been downstream from the fact that the decision was flawed. And so here we are. This is where we wound up. Everybody knew we would wind up here eventually. But it's not as if, you know, we're completely trapped.
Yeah. Very fascinating, Jen. I wouldn't have run my mouth as long had I known. I knew where you were. We're philosophically on this whole thing, but I had no idea you had been so deep in the weeds on this all.
Deep in the weeds. And I worked for many politicians and at various levels of government who, you know, staked their careers on choice issues. And it was the same thing. When it comes time to make phone calls for support, you know, it has always pivoted around this issue for all of these reasons that we're talking about. So it's been a long time coming, and it's been more polarized than anything else, you know, any other political issue. And some of that, you know, by design.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, by design. That's fascinating. So now what's going to happen, instead of all the preparation and angst, instead we're going to get all these people are actually just going to have to do their job.
Well, yeah, they're going to have to resort to the legislative process, God forbid.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you want to pass a you know, I don't know if the mic is going to pick up the guinea pigs up there or not, but I'll pause for a second.
Yeah.
they're agitated. They're looking for snacks.
They're also upset about this decision.
Yeah, they're very upset about it. So, but yeah, I mean, this is, I watch and wonder as Republicans celebrate this moment at, you know, as, and this is what we've been fighting for. And this is, you know, God is great for giving us this victory, and Trump is great for making it happen. And as if it's this wonderful boon to Republican fortunes, when it is quite the opposite, at least in the short term, where you've just, you know, completely invigorated the Democratic efforts for the midterms, where you had this party that was, you know, fighting a completely upstream battle with the economy as it is, with the levels of approval for Biden absolutely in the toilet compared to, I mean, I think he's the most unpopular president since William Howard Taft at this point. And I mean, the Democrats were facing a real, real rough road. I use Glenn Youngkin as my example, the current governor of Virginia, who scored this upset victory here. And in large part, it was because of there's a certain class of moderate Republican-leaning women, but who still pride themselves on fairly progressive values, at least when it suits them, who were very concerned about a lot of the sort of cultural values that alarmed them, especially the teaching of critical race theory in schools. That was kind of the big flashpoint here in the Virginia race. And so all of those women who normally, were probably going to vote for the Democratic candidate who, you know, was, it's still, you know, maybe not their favorite, but it's, you don't change horses in midstream. This is, you know, this is our guy. They're all moving into the Youngkin camp. And all of those women are going to flip right back over abortion. They're all going to flip back over a pro-choice issue, because you've just now hit that exact issue that's going to mobilize them. So I think Republicans are going to struggle in the midterms in unnecessary ways. And obviously, this wasn't a legislative process, and they didn't have direct control over it. But I don't think there's cause for crowing about the victory either, and because the country is mostly pro-choice. It's a divisive issue, but it's not. If you allow for, you know, exceptions, it's a largely mostly pro-choice country with a significant majority, and so it's going to be. Ugly. It's going to make things more complicated in the midterms.
Yeah. All good. No worries. Like I said, I don't see a catastrophe. I see, this is kind of one of these deals where, you know, the worst thing that could happen is sometimes the best thing that ever happened. Like, let's just get it out of the way. And now we have this much of it settled. And now the entire, country in all of its all the little nooks and crannies can adapt to the new situation. And I think the adapting of the new situation will be, you know, successful, so that most people can see and get out of their existence with respect to this issue, whatever it is that they want.
Yeah, that's where I had lost track of where I was going with that last rant, but it was this, there will now be this huge congressional push to pass a federal, you know, mandate, a federal law that guarantees the right to abortion. So that will be a huge mobilizing force in the midterms. It's going to raise a lot of money for the Democrats.
Yeah. All right. Well, now we get to sit back and see what happens. All good. All right. What else we got, Nathan? That's the biggest thing going on.
That's a big. That seems like that was all across the news of the last week or so.
Yeah. Of course.
But yeah, we have some questions about because I figure maybe we can talk about the question on body positivity and women with hair, since we're on the topic of women and choice. What do you think, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle?
Sure, go for it, Nathan. Let's hear.
All right. Dear doctors, there's so much about body positivity on the media and women growing their body hair out, especially. On social media, I read many positive comments on this, but especially from women, while some men are making rather jokey comments. I was just wondering what might be the motivation for women who keep saying stuff like, good on her, or if only I was braver, I'd do the same thing. Like, they're all claiming that removal of body hair is forced upon us by recent culture. Is it, though? I personally, as a woman, hate my body hair and have removed it since before puberty. To me, it actually feels natural to remove it. So I wonder if there is any perspective on this specific topic from the evolutionary psychology perspective.
I think I remember my certainty about having answered this question. I think we did answer it on AJ Doug. That's my recollection, is that probably this person also asked it there. And I'm interested in your answer here. I will say part of this question that was not on AJ that is the easiest part to answer is the motivational question of other women who say things like good for her and if only I was braver. I mean, this is straight up competitive advantage. It's like, yes, you're gonna encourage that other female who is in competition for the same mates to let that hair grow out, let those pits get stinky, ahead and allow herself to be less potentially attractive to the same mate that you were competing for. You don't need to wear makeup. You look great without it. You just health at every size. You're doing great. You go, girl.
Why do anything so sexist and patriarchal as wear high heels?
Exactly.
It's ridiculous.
Why would you try to make yourself more attractive for a man? Boy, you're a sucker. So yes, I think the motivation of women is often not particularly pure when it comes to this kind of conversation. Obviously, there are some women who deeply believe in that, and they really are cheering on the sisterhood. And there is going back to our bodies ourselves, the origins of that kind of movement and that sort of literature was in a very different place than where you're going to encounter it these days. And so I'd be pretty skeptical of that sort of thing. But as for the larger question of, the kind of what's going on here and what's the sort of evolutionary perspective on body hair, I think on AJ, we sort of came down to, we wanted to establish this as actual fact, that there actually is a preference for less body hair on women cross-culturally, because we're not sure that there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not sure there is at all. And so, now, On the flip side of that, the males and hair, facial hair, for example, is going to be signaling maturity, and so that's we can see that there could be an advantage for males, because since a male that's 11 or 12 may not be able to grow a mustache, but somebody who's 22 can. That is a legitimate signaling device for sexual maturity, and therefore to not have that, to not be signaling that, could be leaving you at a competitive disadvantage. So that's I think there's truth in that, and I don't know how big of an effect size that is. It's probably not a huge effect size, but it may not be trivial. So I don't actually know.
Yeah, I think on Chef AJ show, Dr. Lyle, when you didn't shave and had the little thing, I think every woman on that show commented about how great you looked.
Which is amazing. And of course, and what my point of all that is, we don't know about the 10 other women who thought it was disgusting, but wouldn't say so. You know what I'm saying? So we don't actually, we can't use one little snippet there. Although I haven't shaved off my goatee. But the point is that on the male side, I could see it. The female side, I don't see, there's not an obvious evolutionary reason why we would be wanting to remove hair, because unless a lot of hair might be signaling, for example, a lot of hair under arms or on legs, etc., could be a signal of a high amount of testosterone.
That's the only thing that comes to mind. But I think you've got to control for that, you know, across ethnicities and everything else.
Right.
And so are you going to see the same pattern in sort of where in countries where you just have hairier women in general, are the less hairy women still more attractive to the males within that context? I don't know. I really don't know.
Right.
So that's an interesting question. It's also, I think we were wondering if it's true that women, I think there's this intuition that hairlessness is a marker of youth. But is that true? Are women less hairy when they're younger than they are when they're older? And we had some people mentioning that actually it's quite the opposite. So that women get less hairy as they get older. So in that case, it doesn't work as a youth cue either. But I could totally see it as a testosterone cue or an estrogen cue.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we have a little bit of egocentric bias in Western culture. You know, also what we're subjected to media wise, like this questioner is asking. But then there's also, you know, like, you know, body hair is a little pheromone nest.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be completely losing all of it, because you're not going to be properly broadcasting your pheromones to potential mates. So there's a lot of interesting dimensions to this question, and we just don't know our fundamentals on it, frankly.
Right. That's where we are. We're a little bit lost, and it's kind of interesting. Let's think about, I mean, an interesting thing that we see a lot of, we don't see women, I don't think, Jen, I've not that I know a lot about what women are doing, but they'll shave their legs, but they're not going to shave hair off of their arms, I don't think, or not typically, do they?
It depends. A lot of women do. Okay. A lot of women feel really freaked out by arm hair. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, some women are just really uncomfortable unless they are lasering it all away. You know, I think it depends on a lot of factors.
Right.
But I've hung out with hippies who never shave at all for any reason for anybody. And I've hung out with women who really are super, super uncomfortable and feel very self-conscious if they have the least bit of hair on their hands or their arms. So, there's a lot of variation there.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Can't answer the question any better than that.
It's fascinating.
This
is the one that stumps you guys.
It actually occurs
after 6 years.
To me. Yeah. I'm trying to think also, it was occurring to me that there, why even speculate? But I was thinking that there could be an arc of hair, and to the point where it could get less late, but less early, and then more in the middle, etc. So in other words, it's so who knows? You know, it's just really not enough to go on. Give it up, Nathan. We'll go on to something else.
It's you know, after 6 years or so, this is the question that stumps you both.
Is an answer. I mean, this is the kind of question, ironically, that there's probably a pretty good literature on. We just don't know it.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm sure if we really looked into it, we could find some people who have explored this.
Clearly not.
See, what's curious about this to me is it would be, if you're looking through evolution, through the lens of evolution, you would argue that it would be very unlikely that women shaving hair would make them more attractive.
Right. Okay? Because it's,
in other words, that it doesn't make any sense.
Okay, not now, something they're accidentally stumbling onto, or it's, right. It's yeah, it's not a mutation.
Now, right. Now, men shaving their facial hair, I could see as a way to make themselves appear more youthful and then potentially less threatening, and therefore better for business. In other words, you're looking safer to the boss. You can almost imagine, you know, a guy coming in to interview for a job with a bunch of facial hair, and them just thinking, "Who is this badass dude? He's going to be hitting on all the secretaries," and you know what I mean. And he's kind of a bad
motorcycle outside.
Totally. In other words, it's a very different than some guy that comes in, you know, looking like he's out of Salt Lake City. And it's like he's all buttoned down, white collar, and everything looks like this guy will follow every rule and never get one inch out of line. And i.e., it's actually a more submissive display.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I can even tell you, since I grew my little thing, I feel more like a badass, Jen. I just do. Actually, when I look in the mirror, I feel like I look tougher than I actually am, or that
you
I
even
feel.
Wore dark. You words, even wore a darker shirt too the next time.
I don't know, but as that has to do with anything, that's only because that was the only thing left in the that hadn't been still available. No, but I think that the curious thing is, even looking at myself, it looks like a meaner individual.
Mm.
And it's like, that's very interesting. I never had ever that reaction before. And so and if I'm having that reaction, I believe we're all having that reaction. You know what I'm saying? In other words, we're picking up a little more disagreeable, a little more testosteronized,
dominance,
you know, et cetera.
But that's part of my hesitancy on this is, like, I have the subjective feeling if I've just recently shaved my legs, I feel more feminine, but I don't trust that to be an innate intuition. I can't control for the cultural, like, artifact there. And so my sense of how I feel hairy versus hairless is, it's like something that I don't want to extrapolate too much on, because I do feel it's very culturally informed. You know, I have been exposed to that, you know, beauty standard really comprehensively from age zero. And so and a lot of evolutionary psychology, of course, is like, well, the beauty standard didn't come from nowhere. It's reflecting, right, you know, innate preferences. Cool. But this is one of those things where it's like, is it though? Like, to what degree is it? And if it is, why? What is the evolutionary logic of it? So it's an interesting question.
Well, for the male, the logic's clear.
For the male, the logic's clear. Yep.
But if you think about this, let's just take one step here. Okay, let's suppose it's also, in other words, what it could be doing is that let's say a woman shaves her legs, that makes her more like somebody who's 10 or 11 or 12.
Right, but you shot me down on that before when you said men are not attracted to prepubescent.
Yes, yeah. Yes, but it doesn't have to be an attraction issue. It can be essentially submission. A more submissive
an
issue.
An innocent submissive.
Yes.
Yeah, perhaps. Right. Perhaps.
Yes. So it could be basically a way to artificially signal that characteristic, and that may be in some ways more attractive. Okay, So in other words, it's not necessarily a sexual thing per se. It's actually signaling a more submissive posture, and that makes that valuable. So that's possible.
It's possible.
In other words, it could be an accidental discovery that winds up actually tickling that instinct of the male feeling like you're young, you're innocent, you're more submissive, mm-hmm. and therefore theoretically more pliable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not bad. That's a real possibility that's true.
For making it up on the fly, that's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
What would need to be, what other things would need to be true in order for that hypothesis to be true?
I think it wouldn't necessarily be a bad, it's not exact, but there's a messy guess in here that the more agreeable the female, the more she might be wanting to shave her legs. In other words, you could stretch and say, well, if they're real disagreeable, they're needing to hide that disagreeability behind a signal of submissiveness and innocence.
Could it be like a more submissive?
I don't know how you disentangle that.
Could it be a more submissive female sexually versus dominant in bed?
Oh, that is possible. That's again another possibility.
Or at least it signals that if there is a testosterone, if more hair means more testosterone, less hair, less testosterone, you're more submissive, all things equal. So if you can mimic it by shaving the hair off, then you're sending that signal.
It's actually an interesting thing for somebody else to figure out.
Yeah. Well, David Buss's lab, get right on that.
Hey, you got it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's hear from our listeners. Let's hear from our listeners and have them email me and see what kind of answers we get. Beatyourjeans@gmail.com. See what they tell us.
Yeah. All right. We've got a couple more names.
Sure.
Nathan?
Yeah. And by the way, for those enjoying this high level analysis, make sure to visit the Living Wisdom Library. For more of the
I think it's Q&As. The opposite of a high level analysis. I think it's Doug and Jen just talk shit about what might be happening in the world with absolutely no evidence whatsoever.
We do
a lot of that in the Living Wisdom Library. So if you're into that, then
esteemdynamics.com.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, Nathan, what else we got on?
All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about what is your erudite opinion on why the blank slate model seems to particularly appeal to certain character types more than others?
Well, just go ahead. Just go off, Jen.
I mean, I think the character type it appeals most to is the competitively unsuccessful. there's many different ways that we could take this. But there, of course, are some personalities who are more receptive to certain worldviews than others. And one of the things that the blank slate model or the worldview does is it allows you to imagine that you have infinite possibilities in front of you. And if you're not accomplishing everything that you believe that you should be accomplishing, or you have not reached the pinnacle of success that you believe that you should have attained, that there's somebody or something to blame for that rather than just your innate characteristics and capacities. And so I think there are personality types who are attracted to it, but I think more so than personality types, there are situations that are attracted to it. I was most attracted to blank slate thinking when I was feeling at my most competitive, defeated, when I was kind of in early recovery from alcoholism and looking for forces in my childhood to blame for all of my problems and just very receptive to arguments that absolved me of both responsibility and gave me that hope, that sort of potential hope that, okay, if only we can heal the past, if only we can sort of isolate these terrible things that happened and set you off course and correct for them, then you still are capable of accomplishing the highest potential that you can imagine for yourself. That's an incredibly attractive idea for anybody who is feeling unsuccessful or just less successful than they feel they should be. It's also an incredibly attractive ideal for parents who are looking at their children and, the little genetic packages that those children are carrying around with them and wanting them to be as successful reproductively as they possibly can be and imagining that they're capable of absolutely great things. And therefore, as a parent, I have this responsibility to create that situation that is going to give them the greatest possible advantages. That makes me feel more relevant and important as a parent. And it allows me to feel all sorts of excitement for their potential success in the future. So I think those are the forces that influence people and their openness and receptivity to blank slate thinking, that and the fact that they're inundated with it psychologically, culturally, day in, day out. So I think most people are probably pretty receptive to it, actually, unless they are sort of disagreeable types who of the sort who are listening to this podcast. So, yeah, that's my this is the general kind of strokes that I see when I look at this. But I'm sure there are other ways that we can think about it.
I can actually remember it was sometime in the middle of grad school. It was a ways in, maybe year three or year four. I mean, it might have been as late as year three, is when I first heard Irvin Gottesman come in. He came in to give a guest lecture to some hokey testing class that I had to take, and God knows what it was on. It was probably on the MNPI, and which isn't a terrible instrument. But he came in, and we were learning the MNPI, and then he showed people and told us about them and who they were related to, and then put their relative or their twin up on the screen. That was the first time that I actually understood that personality was genetic. I did not know that until then. And so I went through my undergraduate completely. In other words, the only thing that was, I had heard the term sociobiology, and it was explained in four sentences with an eye roll and derision by the major professor for personality at UC San Diego, a guy by the name of Ebbie Ebbison, who had trained under Phil Zimbardo at Stanford. So he was a straight social psychology derivative, blank slate model, learning theory model dude all the way, and he wound up being the head of the department at UC San Diego. And so I worked for him as a TA, and so I came to all his lectures, and he was like, he didn't even pound on Wilson, Edward O. Wilson and behavior genetics or anything. He just totally dismissed it. He was like, no, it's totally ridiculous. And then he went on to brag about studies and show studies. And I came out of there, I was completely convinced of essentially blank slate. And then I went to grad school, and nothing really changed for a couple of years. I was, I don't know when I even got, I heard the term behavior genetics because we had recruited Sandra Scar from out of Harvard, and she became the head of the department down there, very controversial. And a lot of the professors were upset and unhappy and thought Sandra Scar was, you know, this draconian bitch. And it didn't help that University of Virginia had a long history of Mary Ainsworth and Bowlby style developmental psychology, essentially blank slate, mother infant, offspring attachment being the causal force in personality differentiation. And Sandra Scar's coming in and saying, no, that's total bullshit. It's all genetics.
Right.
And
blowing the place
up. So, yeah, she totally just brought in a TNT and just set it off right in the middle
of
the building.
It's amazing that department, you know, it must have been some very loud voices in support of bringing her in, like politically to bring her in. I mean, she was a huge name, but still.
Yeah. I have no idea how that happened.
How that happened.
So,
yeah.
It was really lucky for me because. And when I heard about it, I was, you know, my major professor, Tim Wilson, was, of course, blank slate all the way.
Right.
And so he was, so everybody that I learned from was blank slate. And so they're all like, you know, snarling under their breath and rolling their eyes about Sandra Scar, who also happened to be a raging alcoholic.
Mm.
And so it, she wasn't doing her, what do you call it, advertisement much good by... all of us could see that she was in trouble. Mm. And
that's
so
why Harvard was happy to unload her.
Oh, that, you know what?
Yeah.
Actually,
Virginia got her
that,
cheap.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, she may have been like actually, under some disciplinary action and looking to save face and downgraded. That's probably what happened.
Thanks a lot, Jen. Yeah. Downgraded to the university.
Sorry. It's just true.
Just slipped out. The way truth comes out of the mouths of babes, right? But I think, you know what? I had never put that together. But I'll bet you that was probably in the game.
Yeah, that was probably some deal struck between the two institutions. So here you can have her. She's vintage, and you know she comes with a good reputation, but she's damaged goods. Don't let her teach undergrads.
Right, yeah. So, but at any rate, that it wasn't until, like I said, about year three. By year three, I had heard the news, and I changed my opinion basically immediately because I'm a numbers guy, and I'm looking at the numbers. I'm like, whoa, what is this? It's like, whoa, this changes everything. And so soon it became, and it was Irving Gottesman then was recruited out of Harvard as well. And he and Sandra Scar knew each other. So Gottesman came down, and he was big, big wig in behavior genetics and psychopathology, schizophrenia. And so now Gottesman's showing us the data. And I'm finally seeing, it's like, oh, I see now, okay? Wow, all of these personality characteristics across the MMPI, they're all genetic. And I'm like, wow, that's really, now I'm getting the picture. So a question now that we talk about, you know, blank slate thinking and who thinks what, and like there's some interesting thinking in here, but I have to tell you, the thing that Jen said in her answer was, people are inundated with it.
I mean, it's just the default, you know, you just assume, of course, that's how you are. And part of that is, you know, it's we observe that with, it's how we train our dogs, you know, it's
yes.
And it looks like kids are imitating their parents. And yes. So you just have this sort of intuition, and everybody has shit happen in their childhood, and everybody has competitive problems in adulthood. And it looks like you can just fit them together very neatly. You can come up with a story very easily. And that story is validated everywhere you look. And you know, people with fancy letters behind their name nod and affirm that your interpretation is correct. And, you know, that's why we have to relearn our childhood patterns and heal the things that happen to us. And it just all seems to make perfect sense.
It's like psychological junk food.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, it shows you how, far afield you can get when you have a mistake. You've got a false premise.
Right.
And so we wind up then doing, you know, a bunch of useless and damaging processes behind, quote, psychotherapy, because we actually don't understand what we're looking at. And so we wander, you know, we wander way off the reservation of truth. That's what happens.
Well,
exactly what happened.
And as you and I have talked about many times, and as we talk about in the book, there's this whole, you know, there's so many incentive structures all the way down. There's, you know, you can't make money telling parents there's nothing they can do to help their children.
Right.
Like, there's nothing you can, your baby Einstein is not going to do anything for the you know, your kid's not going to get into a certain college because you're playing baby Einstein in the womb. So I think there's just the marketing impulse of selling eager parents every single new trick and possibility to give their kids a competitive advantage, which of course every parent wants to give their kid a competitive advantage. That creates just market upon market upon market for people to capitalize on that.
Sure.
And so it doesn't even have to be within the psychology realm. It's in the industrial realm. It's everywhere.
Yes.
So there's so much innate resistance on the part of parents in particular to being told they're irrelevant to the development of their children and their eventual successful outcomes that you can't sell that. You can't make any money on it. And you have this profound academic bias that becomes entrenched over the years and perpetuates itself one thesis at a time for decades. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. There we go.
There we go.
Amazing.
All good.
Well, we talked about the whole gamut.
Nathan.
We talked about body hair.
There we go.
Roe v. Wade. And then the competitive realities of the blank slate model.
There you go.
Yeah.
There, wasn't there something else in there that was kind of juicy? I forgot.
There is, I think, but I have a phone consult.
I just forget. Who cares? Now the guinea pig is upset.
Yeah,
the
I think I think they hear Michael on the stairs, and usually that means somebody's bringing them bamboo leaves to eat. So they formed very good little correlations. they hear us on the stairs, and they're like, "It's time for snacks."
It's like Melissa said, they're just making sure that Michael knows where they are at all times, right?
Yeah,
the kids on the playground.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. Totally. Yep. Yeah. Well, they're very cute and they provide a lot of good compost. So
there you go.
Well,
yeah.
Well, wonderful. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for your analysis on the Roe v. Wade. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much for kind of bringing that perspective of, that it won't be quite doom and gloom. There's things to do about it. And it's a different time frame now than it was, 50 years ago.
Absolutely. Completely different.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it.
All right, Nathan. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we will talk to both of you guys in just a couple of weeks. And for those people who are wanting to hear more, just sign on to the Living Wisdom Library at esteemdynamics.com so you guys can see more Q&A.
Perfect.
Awesome.
All right, Nathan.
See you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Have a good
one. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G, Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.